I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is celebrity kosher chef Jeff Nathan, host of the PBS TV show The New Jewish Cuisine, and one of the finest kosher chefs in the world. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Chanukah Sameach. It's Chanukah now, the fifth day of the great Jewish Festival of Lights and Religious Freedom today. There's an interesting history to this holiday and a controversial one. In fact, Chanukah has a more complicated and ambivalent history than nearly any other Jewish festival. The historical events Chanukah celebrates are reasonably well known. Way back in the 2nd century BCE, nearly 2,200 years ago, Israel was part of the Seleucid Empire, created after Alexander the Great's early death, formed under his general Seleucus. In that powerful kingdom, the Greek Hellenistic culture, with its theaters and bathhouses and gymnasiums and pagan temples, was encroaching steadily on all the local cultures, including the Jews. But generally, the relationship was peaceful. To set the scene, Greek-style towns and cities were generally founded next to older Jewish towns and cities. Next to them, but not really like them. The Greeks and the Hellenized locals who lived in the Greek towns wrestled at the gym, bathed in the hot and cold public baths, did business in the agora, attended performances and concerts in theaters and amphitheaters, studied and argued philosophy and poetics, and worshipped a plethora of pagan gods in multiple temples. Jews who lived near them in the Jewish urban areas bathed in private mikvahs, shopped in the small stores near their homes, ate kosher food, studied the Torah and the Bible, attended a Beit Midrash, a house of study, regularly, made pilgrimages to the great temple in Jerusalem 3 times a year for the festivals, and worshiped the one God. The two communities coexisted uneasily but peacefully. But the egotism that seems to accompany every position of real power in the world intervened. A king of this Seleucid Empire, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, decided it wasn't enough just to rule. He also needed to be literally worshipped as a god, as his idol Alexander the Great had been. Antiochus deified himself and insisted his subjects worship him in addition to whatever their own gods were. In Israel, a small but strategically located backwater of the great empire, the Jews worshipped the one God. When decrees went out requiring that statues of Antiochus were to be erected in every town in Israel, and particularly that a great statue of the evil king would be placed in the holy temple in Jerusalem, the Jewish people reacted with shock. But most Jews, cowed by the power of the greatest army in the world at that time, simply complied. Not all, however, and soon Antiochus, called Antiochus by Jews, moved to force them to worship him. And so to suppress what became the outlawed religion of Judaism, the teaching of Torah was banned on punishment of death. Circumcision and keeping kosher were made capital crimes. In particular, any instruction of children in the ways of our ancestors was absolutely forbidden. Laws were enforced by squads of soldiers armed with spears, swords, and bows and arrows. To emphasize the religious subjugation of the Jews, distinctly unkosher pigs were sacrificed on the altar of the temple itself, and the lights of the sacred menorah were extinguished. Judaism looked like it, too, was about to be extinguished. At this time of greatest darkness, one family rose up and refused to bow to the idol of Antiochus, the first real evil emperor. Led by Mattathias, Mattathias in the Greek pronunciation, a family known as the Hasmoneans struck back. At first, many Jews simply complied with Antiochus' demands. His army was the most powerful. There was no alternative. But finally, the oppressed people of Israel could stand it no longer. The rebellion began in an obscure town in the Judean hills called Modi'in, with the overthrow of a tax collector and refusal to bow down to the statue. The Hasmoneans, soon led by the most dynamic of Mattathias' sons, Judah, began a guerrilla war. Hiding out in caves and in forests, striking at the better armed and more numerous Seleucids, it was a careful campaign that gathered strength over time. In spite of the use of battle elephants brought from the Seleucid Empire's Indian possessions, the tanks of that era, in spite of all the military advantages that seemed to lie with the occupying power, the Jews, led by Judah the Hammer, Maccabee in Hebrew, gained the upper hand. The Syrian Greeks were driven from the main part of Israel and finally from the temple in Jerusalem, which was cleansed and prepared and turned again into proper condition for sanctification. Its rededication took place at a great festival of thanksgiving and dedication, what we call Chanukah. The lights of the Chanukah menorah remind us of the great miracle of our salvation from religious persecution, of the triumph of the few over the many, the weak over the strong, the believers over those who tried to destroy us. Now the controversial parts. The remarkable victory of Chanukah was celebrated with this 8-day festival, but the leaders of that victory, the Maccabee family, known as the Hasmoneans, were corrupted by power too. And when we Jews decided which holidays should be celebrated fully, Chanukah gradually diminished in religious importance. Until the last century, when it has made a huge comeback, it is now in America the second most widely celebrated Jewish festival after Passover, perhaps tied with it by now. And that's okay, because Chanukah does remember an incredibly important set of events, and it's a great holiday. There's a beautiful prayer we say each night just after lighting the Chanukah licht, the candles that remember these historical events in the Chanukiah. It's often sung, Hanerot Halalu, we light these candles to remember the great miracles you wrought for our ancestors at this time of year, in those days long ago, as sung by a group called Voices of Winter. That was Voices of Winter singing Hanerot Halalu, these lights. You know, when Hanukkah and Christmas coincide as they do today, and I see all the focus on Christmas commercialism, I feel a need to play this next musical cut. Here's the now classic, that means it's in its second year, Hanukkah Christmas shtick by Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert called Can I Interest You in Hanukkah?
Can I interest you in Hanukkah? Maybe something in a festival of lights. It's a sensible alternative to Christmas, and it lasts for 7 for you. 8
Hanukkah, huh? I've never really thought about it.
Well, you could do worse.
Is it merry?
It's kind of merry.
Is it cheery?
Got some cheer.
Is it jolly?
Look, I wouldn't know from jolly, but it's not my least unfavorite time of year.
When's it start?
On the 25th.
Of December?
Kislev.
Which is when exactly?
I will check.
Are there presents?
Yes, indeed, 8 days of presents, which means one nice one, then a week of dread.
Does Hanukkah commemorate events profound and holy? A king who came to save the world?
No, oil that burned quite
slowly.
Well, it sounds fantastic.
There's more.
We have latkes.
What are they?
Potato pancakes. We have dreidels.
What are they?
Wooden tops. We have candles.
What are they?
They are candles.
And when we light them, oh, the fun, it never stops.
What do you say, Stephen? You want to give Hanukkah a try?
I'm trying to see me as a Jew. I'm trying even harder. But I believe in Jesus Christ, so it's a real non-starter.
I can't interest you in Hanukkah. Just a little bit.
No thanks, I'll pass. I'll keep Jesus, you keep your potato pancakes.
But I hope that you enjoy them on behalf of all the goyim. Be sure to tell the pontiff, my people say good yontif.
That's exactly what I'll do.
Happy holidays, you.
That was Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert from their holiday special song, Can I Interest You in Hanukkah? You know, our choir director at Temple Emmanuel, Chris Tackett, and I performed that at my synagogue for our greatest Hanukkah on Earth celebration 2 weeks ago, and I have to say, we were even better than they were. Of course, they did it first, and they wrote it, but I do sing better than Jon Stewart. It's nice to know there's something I do better than Jon Stewart besides read Hebrew. Our guest this morning is the outstanding kosher chef, Jeff Nathan, whose show on public television for the past 13 years, The New Jewish Cuisine, is the only international Jewish cooking show, and who is one of the finest kosher chefs in the world. Find out how that is both challenging and rewarding when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
The other day, I was at a business networking breakfast, and I introduced myself to the fella sitting next to me by saying, "Hi, Joe Spina, of Mama's Pizza." Without missing a beat, he said, "I know, you're the, now repeat after me guy." Well, it was clear he'd heard my commercials before, but the guy sitting next to us was a little puzzled. Obviously, he had no idea who I was. So I tried a little experiment. I asked the first guy to tell the second guy what he knew about Mama's just from hearing our commercials. "Easy," he said. "Mama's is a family-run restaurant that's been around Tucson a long time. One of the things they have is a huge pizza called the Family Size. Oh, and they pride themselves on having great atmosphere and value." So there, in about 10 seconds, this guy who had never heard of Mama's before basically knew the whole story. And now, so do you. Except that we have four convenient locations in Tucson. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Chef Jeffrey Nathan. sophisticated, flavorful, creative recipes, and by far the most talked about kosher food in the nation, all served at Abigail's in New York. Chef Nathan is one of the most popular chefs in the market overall. He has been the chef host of public television's New Jewish Cuisine, the only international gourmet kosher cooking series, seen in 4 countries, translated into 3 languages. His cookbooks, Adventures in Jewish Cooking, and Jeff Nathan's Family Suppers are available worldwide. He's the executive chef at the Abigail's Group, including Abigail's and the Green Tea Lounge. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
So, a little off the wall, you started your restaurant career, really, kind of doing turnarounds on restaurants in New York, didn't you?
Pretty much, yeah. I used to buy and sell them, and buy them at Chapter 11 and sell them and try to make a profit anyway. And then I just sort of got stuck with the kosher. It was just ended up working out really well. It's something that sort of became dear to my heart. It started to take off. The kosher consumer was looking for the type of cuisine I was trying to do. And I said, you know what? This is definitely my calling. Let's forget buying and selling, and let's stay here and make a real career out of it. And I think it's the best thing I've ever done.
You know, a lot of people feel like it's just too hard to cook kosher food, that kosher food can't possibly be as good because of the dietary requirements. And yet sometimes we find things like, you know, the fascinating new concept of actually brining meat has become very popular. That seems kind of kosher to me. Tell us what the challenges are with creating really gourmet kosher food.
You know what? It's never-ending battle, and it's not just with kosher food. It's with kosher wine. Everybody feels as soon as they hear the word kosher, they're thinking of manischewitz and sweet wine, or they're thinking of chicken soup and brisket, and not that there's anything wrong with that. But there are other types of foods. So when I got involved in kosher, I looked at the glass as being half full, not half empty. My painter's palette was limited, meaning that in the non-kosher world, you have a painter's palette of 1,000 colors. You can create a Rembrandt. Your pictures become amazing with nuances and intricacies. With the palette for kosher cooking, it was sort of limited. So yes, you could create a picture, but you only have a few colors. It's changed today after the 13 years I've been involved in kosher. The kosher consumers have demanded ingredients that non-kosher people have. So the big food companies, whether it's Hain Celestial or Kraft or Nabisco, they've all started to concentrate now on making a lot of their items kosher, which gives me and the kosher consumers a great opportunity to have foods that are much more varied. 13 years ago, there was no such thing as me getting kosher. Wasabi and rice wine vinegar and white truffle oil and all these great ingredients now. So the challenges to me, honestly, are behind me. I really think today that if you look at my menu, you wouldn't even know it was kosher. It's a modern American food. It just happens to be kosher.
We will talk much more with Jeff Nathan when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmaker's Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter, Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1- and 2-bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation. 322-7035 or visit handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor.
Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear past and present shows through our website or downloading us from there or at the Apple iTunes store is very popular Jewish podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set for May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in going, email me at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or call 327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. Well, happy Hanukkah. As we say it in my temple, Chag Chanukah Sameach. Hanukkah has a very special personal connection for me, and today is the key day. You see, it was in the year 2000 that my best Hanukkah story took place. My youngest child, my daughter Tzipora, was born December 25th, 2000, at St. Joseph's Hospital here in Tucson, Arizona. She was born about 5 a.m. The doctor didn't actually make it on time. The delivery nurse had to do the honors. I guess the doctor was busy wrapping last-minute Hanukkah presents that morning. In any case, a couple of hours after Tzipora's birth, there was a knock on the hospital room door. It seems that a reporter was there from the local Kagan 9 news station. She wanted to film the first baby born on Christmas in St. Joseph's Catholic Hospital in Tucson. And Tzipora Kohan was the one. So I went in the hall and discovered the reporter, of course, was Jewish. I mean, who else is working at that hour on Christmas? She asked if it would be okay to film, and I said, you can film, but you have to say that this is the first baby born on Christmas in St. Joseph's Catholic Hospital, but she's the rabbi's daughter from Temple Emmanuel, and she's a Hanukkah baby. By the way, Tzipora is still certain the stores are closed in honor of her birthday today, and why would I argue? So happy birthday to the Hanukkah baby of the year 2000, turning 11 today, Tzipora Kohan. Yom Huledet Sameach. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning and Chag Chanukah Sameach.
Boker Tov, Chag Chanukah Sameach.
Happy Hanukkah. There was a big ad campaign that the Israeli government or the foreign ministry under Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister, had prepared for, I guess, release to the American media. They bought ads. And it was a campaign about a month ago to try to bring Israelis back to Israel, ones who had moved to the United States. And there was a very interesting little vignette in one of those where they're talking by Skype to Bubby, to Savta in Israel, the Israeli family, and she says, oh, what holiday is it now, kids? And she's got a Chanukiah behind her. And the kids say, oh, it's Christmas. Well, today it's both. Let's talk about that campaign, what it meant and what its implications are for sort of Israeli, American Jews relationships.
Okay. Should we say Merry Christmas on this day? Okay. First of all, one small correction. It wasn't Avigdor Lieberman's ministry. It was the minister for Aliyah, for Klitat Aliyah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which is a different one. Now, the interesting point about those ads is the big fuzz they created within the American Jewish community. A lot of voices came out shouting, how can Israel criticize us? Now, I must admit, the ads were done with somewhat of a bad taste. Okay, they did look to me to be a little too simplistic and too provocative. On the other hand, ads usually tend to be too simplistic and too provocative, period.
If they're too complicated, they don't work.
Exactly. But the big fuss they created kind of suggested that, hey, they touched something significant. They exposed something that hurts people. And I think that question of Jewish identity and where does Jewish people go, and even more specifically regarding to Israeli that immigrate to the U.S., how do they maintain their Jewishness going forward to the next generation, are big questions that we don't always answer. Looking at the Jewish community today, most of the couples, of the young couples, include at least one, well, not at least, they include one spouse who's not Jewish. And that brings a big dilemma into the family life. How do you educate the kids? Do the kids go to shul or do they go to church? Do you light the candles on Friday or do the kids believe in Jesus? And those questions are significant. Those questions are significant even if you're not religion. Going just to the shopping mall and seeing Santa Claus. You know, my small daughter came to me the other day, "Hey, Daddy, I love Santa." And I told her, "You know, he's not Jewish." She said, "I don't care." You know?
it's not real also, but I guess it's okay to say that today, December 25th, that they got their presents and everything. But so let's talk a little bit beyond the intermarriage issue next week, maybe, about what this implies about Israel's understanding of Jews who moved to America and America's understanding, American Jews' understanding of what it means to be an American Jew and what role Israel plays in that. Because certainly at this time of year, it's really stark, right? Hanukkah and Christmas the same day. And you're overwhelmed by Christmas in this country. But there's something else going on, too. And I agree. Let's explore it much more next week.
Sure thing, and happy Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah, Guy, and we'll see you next secular year.
Okay.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And Chag Hanukkah Sameach, happy Hanukkah, and many happy returns of my daughter Tzipora's birthday today, December 25th.
And Merry Christmas to all our non-Jewish listeners
exactly.
And friends.
Exactly. We were talking about the degrees of separation. You had a great story.
Well, we hadn't quite gotten to that. We were talking about how it was that I knew this very famous French politician, and that was a little bit of Jewish geography, and it was also a little bit of professional networking. And Jews love to play this game of, are you related to so-and-so? Oh, no, but I know his mother-in-law, his cousin. And, you know, because there's a small number of Jews in the world, and they're intensely family-oriented and networked, they tend to think that they're more closely connected than other groups. But recently, it seems, Facebook commissioned a survey from some renowned, prestigious Italian university, which found that it's not 6 degrees of separation that separate all of us, but more like 4.2 degrees, depending on what part of the world we live in. And most people can be connected with either 4 or 5 intermediate steps. And I recently had an example of this. It has nothing to do with being Jewish and just boggled my mind, which is I was in the gym on a Sunday working out, came out of the shower, wrapped myself up prior to going to the sink to shave. And this guy sort of says to me, "You work with a personal trainer?" And I couldn't imagine why. It's somebody I'd never seen before. I said, "Yeah, why?" He said, "Well, you're looking really good. Congratulations to you and him." I said, "Thanks." And then 5 minutes later, he's like 3 sinks down from me, and we're both shaving. And so I felt like I had to talk with him some more. I still didn't know his name. I said, like, "What do you do?" "Military intelligence." "Oh, okay. Where have you been?" It turns out that this guy had worked in the defense attaché's office at the U.S. Embassy in Sofia, Bulgaria, 5 years before I was running that embassy as chargé d'affaires. And, you know, what were the odds that two random guys in Tucson using the same gym would have served their country in an obscure place, particularly because I was there right after the fall of communism. So it means he was working there in the defense attaché's office when we probably had a total of three military personnel on the ground because it was the bad old days of communism. And, you know, his boss's locally recruited driver was a colonel in the host country's intelligence services. Right. I mean, it was a real hostile relationship in those days. And so, I mean, it was just an example for me of how if you scratch beneath the surface and actually ask questions, you discover close connections with almost anyone. I mean, we really are one big family of humanity. And at this time of year, when we're all celebrating different traditions and somehow aware of our differences, I think it's useful also to remind ourselves of how close we are and how folks are just folks.
Great message. Thanks, Tom. And happy Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa, and I'm sure there's some others.
New Year.
New Year coming up. Take care.
See you next week.
See you next year. It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Abe walks into the local bar and sees his friend Moishe sitting there. He puts his hand to his heart and yells, "Oy vey, Moishe, I'm so sorry to hear about your factory burning down." Moishe spins around and whispers quickly, "Shh, you idiot. It's tomorrow." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and get the day right. This week, we reach the climax of the great story of Joseph, which fills most of the last five weekly portions of the book of Genesis. As we begin the portion of Vayigash, Joseph has risen to the position of the number two man in all of Egypt. He has become, in Yiddish, a poritz, an important man, a macher, a guy who has assimilated and taken on a role that few Jews have ever held. As my father, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan's song, tells it,
Yosef Avinu is in Mitzrayim a poritz geworden. Translation. Little Joe, he made it big in Egypt. Seine eigene Brüder, ob nim nicht die kennt, ob nim nicht die kennt.
Translation.
His old brothers didn't know him anymore, they didn't dig him anymore. Und vor was haben sie ihn nicht gekannt?
Why didn't they know him?
While cooled ois via poritz und rett via poritz, ein Peitscher ist gestanden in der Mitte. Ois via poritz und rett via poritz, unser Josele ist uns abwandet. He looked like a poritz and he talked like a poritz in a language that his brothers didn't know. He looked like a poritz and he talked like a poritz that couldn't be our little Joe.
Joseph's brothers, who had earlier sold him into slavery and don't know he's come way up in the world since then, come down to Egypt because food is short in Canaan. But as the song continues,
hat sie gekannt und sie haben ihn nicht gekannt. He knew them and they didn't know him. But now listen, how could they possibly know it? I mean, here he was with the beard shaved off in this beautiful penthouse completely overlooking the Nile. Elegantly furnished in early on Gipachkin. And between him and them are standing the aristocrats and the big shots and the interpreters. And besides, like I told you before, Are you ready? He looked like a poritz and he talked like a poritz in a language that his brothers didn't know. He
looked like a porridge and he talked like a porridge. That couldn't be our little Joe. Finally, Joe himself couldn't stand it anymore. He said, send them all out. All the aristocrats, the big shots, the interest, send them all out. And he faced his brothers directly, and he spoke to them for the first time in Hebrew. And he said to them, I'm Yosef. Translation, Ich bin Yosef. Adavichai, said, is my father still alive? They looked at him, and they looked at each other, and they said, it can't be, but it is. Yes, this is our brother. They said, yes, you have a father, you have a family, you have an identity. Yes, they said, we know you now because you're speaking our language, of course.
In other words, Joseph has come to recognize that he has to affirm his own Jewish identity. He has brothers, a father, an existence beyond his job and his own assimilation. Joseph is a Jew, and that matters always, deeply, profoundly. That's the essential meaning of this Torah portion of Vayigash. It's why we are here and why our lives matter. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, the outstanding chef Jeff Nathan, explains how and why he started cooking kosher and what ingredients he'd still like to use but can't yet, when we return in a few moments on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers, you can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K through 12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Every now and then, we here on Two Jewish find ourselves not only reporting the news, but present at its creation. Last week, we attended the Union for Reform Judaism Biennial Convention in Washington, D.C., and President Barack Obama addressed the conference in person, attended by over 6,000 Reform Jews, the largest such convention ever. This marked the first time a sitting president has ever spoken to a Reform convention. And after a five-hour wait for security and his arrival, he was very entertaining and effective. President Obama noted that his daughter is always going to bar and bat mitzvahs these days. She's at that age, which provoked many knowing laughs among the conventioners. And she has become the family expert on Judaism. He's learned from her that it's always good to start a speech by talking about the Torah portion. And so President Obama did. In his drash, the Joseph story in last week's portion was emblematic of so many struggles for human freedom. President Obama noted that in America, Jews found a country that rewarded hard work and provided opportunity. American Jews have helped make this country more perfect, pursuing tikkun olam. He even kind of pronounced it right, repairing the world. These values led Jewish leaders like Justice Brandeis, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, and so many others to work for what's right in America. The values of Hineni, here I am, to do God's will and what is right in the world motivated them as they motivate Reform Jews today and as they motivate the president himself. He spoke of the positive change embodied by a variety of legislative acts that have been enacted during his presidency, a little cheering for himself, environmental reform, labor reform, health care reform, protection of children, opening family planning to millions of Americans, educational reform. And then he spoke of change. Change, President Obama said, is ending the American war in Iraq this very month. Change has been the direction of legislation and debate towards improving the lives of middle class and impoverished Americans. Obama described his principles of economic justice in a time of crisis. The president stressed that this is not just an economic debate, but a moral debate. Is this a country in which the powerful play by their own rules, or is it a country of real opportunity? And then President Obama highlighted his own administration's profound commitment to Israel's security, to the bedrock relationship between Israel and America. Ehud Barak, the former prime minister of Israel, now the defense minister, whom we heard at the convention, was in the crowd. And the president noted his friendship with Barak and the fact that no previous American administration has been as committed to Israel's security or worked as hard for it or dedicated as many resources to it as has the Obama administration. The president also declared his support for a free, democratic, secure state of Israel next to a free, democratic state of Palestine. May the Messiah come soon. The assembled delegates gave him a standing ovation on this one. Not all Jews would agree, certainly, but the vast majority of Reform Jews at this conference surely did. The president concluded by encouraging our continued dedication to saying Hineni and working to make America a better country in a better world. It was a stirring and effective speech and well-liked by the 6,000 or so delegates assembled in that room. The president was relaxed, funny. He used Hebrew phrases and Jewish ideas and text with fluency. As some noted, he has some pretty fine Jewish speechwriters. His work at the convention cemented the strong relationship President Obama has with the Reform Movement, the largest Jewish movement in the world, at its largest convention ever. Two final stories for our last show of the secular year 2011. The first belongs to the Israel Electric Company in the small southern Israeli kibbutz of Nahal Oz. No one, including service reps at the Israel Electric Company, knows why kibbutz Nahal Oz is repeatedly being sent Hamas's electric bill. That is, the Islamist Palestinian terror group that controls Gaza. The whole electric bill for Gaza is now being sent to a small southern Israeli kibbutz. The statements for power drawn from the Israeli grid by Gazans addressed to the Palestinian Authority, Nahal Oz, continue to arrive by mail every single month. Each is in the vicinity of 7 million shekels, about $1.75 million, not counting the 71 million shekels, close to $20 million, for previous unpaid Hamas electric bills, say the kibbutz accountants. The village, which hugs the Gaza Strip, gets socked coming and going. Not only does it get hit with Palestinians' bills, but also with Palestinians' rockets. And how have the kibbutzniks responded? They laugh at the absurdity of the situation and at their own electric company. And with typical Israeli perversity, in the face of the adversary, they plant a new tree in every crater caused by a mortar or rocket lobbed inside the kibbutz perimeter. And finally, our 2011 prize for cool behavior in a rough situation goes to Tel Aviv chef Adi Abu. After his expensive fish restaurant facing the jetty of the Tel Aviv port was inundated by a huge wave during a fierce storm that left a 10-pound grouper in its wake, the astonished gourmet chef recovered fast. He grabbed the no less floored grouper that was fiercely flapping around like, a fish out of water. The dashing cook multiplied the grouper's plight while making the best of a bad situation. The fish was soon swimming in a savory sauce of fresh tomatoes seasoned with fennel, garlic, and cilantro in the middle of a demolished restaurant. the ultimate case of potluck and pluck, seasoned with a dash of aplomb. And that's the news of Jews round the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Chef Jeffrey Nathan. He is the executive chef of the Abigail's Group, including Abigail's, perhaps the most regarded kosher restaurant in the world, and the Green Tea Lounge in New York. He has a number of projects in the works kind of at all times. He's been the chef host of public television's New Jewish Cuisine since it started back in October of 98, the only international gourmet kosher cooking series. His cookbooks are available worldwide, Jeff Nathan's Family Suppers, Adventures in Jewish Cooking. And he has received a James Beard Award nomination for his work on New Jewish Cuisine for the Best National Television Cooking Series. All right, so one of my favorite things to eat is wild game, and it's been not so easy to find that in the kosher world. Tell us a little bit about what's changed, because after all, that was one of your favorite things to work with.
Right. About 25 years ago, I specialized in for a few years in cooking wild game. It is difficult to get today. It's very, very difficult. I'll tell you the truth, the only thing I really use is venison. There are certain animals that are kosher, but there's not a demand for it. So basically, to try to find these products, it's not really happening. So, I mean, you have bison and venison in the kosher world today. That's pretty much it. And I enjoy using it. It's nice. It's leaner. It's healthier for you. It has less fat. And it's, again, it's something new and novel and different.
What is your most innovative kosher recipe? What was the hardest one to come up with, and what do you like the best?
Oh, my God. How can I don't even know. It's impossible to answer that, because I don't think of items as recipes. I change with seasons. What motivates me and gives me passion are the seasons. When the summer's coming, and all the beautiful berries and the wild mushrooms and the greens and all these things that have come into season gives me a chance to play. With winter coming, I think of now all the heartier mushrooms and the root vegetables and the more long, slow-cooked braised dishes with short ribs and things. So it's really the season that motivates me, the produce that's available. And then once you get bored, what's nice is, guess what? The seasons are changing again, and it gives you a whole other painter's palette. You know, the word I keep using, the painter's palette, those are the tools of my trade. That's what gets my juices flowing with creativity and passion.
You know, the great challenge for so many kosher cooks is, you know, milchik or fleishik, whether you use milk or meat. How did you decide you're going to do that? It was going to be focused ways at Abigail's?
Basically, meat is prosperity, and there's a lot of parties around it, so I really did a meat menu based on the financials. You'll do more business, you can charge more for it, and most parties are celebrated around a fleishik menu. I had a dairy menu for a while at another location, and I liked it a lot, but you just don't have as many parties and things, and you need today in this economy, you need to reach out for everything. You have to do delivery and lunch and parties, and you have to be involved with everything. And the dairy just didn't really bring in the same dollars as a fleishik restaurant. But I actually enjoy them both very much.
How did you grow up? What were you eating?
I was always into food. Always into food. So, I mean, it was not something that was just basic for me. When my parents would go away and the babysitter was there, I'd be making little tchotchkes in the kitchen, crackers and things like that. When I was younger, I was a dishwasher in an Italian restaurant, so food was always important to me. During the holidays, my grandmother and all the women would be in the kitchen cooking and making everything from scratch. The men would have their pants undone watching football in the living room, and I was in the kitchen with them. So it's always been true and dear to my heart. I think I ate everything. I always tried everything. There was never something that I would say, oh, no, or I don't want to do that. And honestly, my children today are the same way. They're open-minded, and they'll try everything. Don't say no. You don't know if you're not going to like it until you try it.
Is there one ingredient or two or something that you would like to see made more commercially available for kosher food?
Yes. It's so hard for me to get the nut oils that I love to work with, the walnut oil and the almond oils. It's just so hard to find one with a Hexture. They had one for a little while, and then it disappeared. A better quality balsamic vinegar, you know, the one we have now is, you know, it's pretty basic. In the non-kosher world, they have 25-year, 50-year, 100-year. I mean, I'd like to find a little more unique items like that. So I think the nut oils and the balsamic, also a great foie gras, that would be superb. Mm.
We're not talking about chopped liver here.
Exactly. Talking about putting chopped liver on steroids.
You know, in Israel, foie gras is very popular. I don't know if you've gone and tasted there, but it doesn't quite come out the same.
Exactly. I mean, there's a farm here. There's a few farms here that produce the most magnificent duck foie gras, not the goose. And right. I would love to have supervision on that. And like you mentioned before, some more game. I would love to have some of Moulard and Muscovy ducks and some quails. But again, there's not enough demand. I mean, that's the key. You got those kosher consumers out there. Hopefully they'll listen to your show and they'll try to reach out. And the more people that are looking for more unique and different items, that's the only time it's going to come up on the shelves.
Well, we'll have to have an Occupy Kosher food movement to encourage people to come out and speak out for more game.
There you go.
More game supervision.
Yeah.
When people come into your restaurant expecting a fine restaurant meal, does anybody ever ask to see the mashgiach? Do you ever have any of that kind of stuff?
Many times, sure. Many times they want to know where the products came from, etc. And, you know, I have a rule with my with my waiters and waitresses. You're not to answer kosherist questions. You need to be familiar with what's going on. But just like with allergens and people, I'm allergic to this and that, you have to double-check in the kitchen.
Right.
So any kosherist questions whatsoever go to the mashgiach. And the mashgiach many times just will answer the waiter with a proper answer, or he'll come out into the kitchen. I'm sorry, he'll come out into the dining room, and he'll speak with them. And then I'll also get phone calls about certain products that we use, etc. And that's why he's there. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's all those questions. I'm paying enough to have a mashgiach, so he's there to answer all those questions and take care of those things.
All right, well, a final question. You were in the Navy for a while when you were young.
Yes.
The Navy is not known for fine cuisine. How did you manage?
Well, you know, I was a dishwasher first and then started cooking at an Italian restaurant and went into the Navy and got some basic schooling for cooking. More technique, you know, it wasn't fine dining, if you will, but, you know, I ended up working my way from cooking for 300 people, cooking for 16 officers, and you end up being able to cook better food. I was also involved in cooking for the 6th Fleet, Menachem Begin and Sadat in Israel during the Carter administration.
Wow.
I had my finger in. I wasn't solely responsible, but I was involved in cooking for them. And it was very, very interesting. But honestly, what the Navy did for me is it gave me a free education. I was able to come out and go to college and have the government sort of subsidize it and pay for it for me. And honestly, as a young kid going in the Navy, it was the best thing I ever did. I traveled the world, met lots of people, had a chance to travel and see different cuisines, and ended up going to the Culinary Institute of America. And the GI Bill did a lot for me.
And you know, the food you cooked for Sadat and Begin undoubtedly led to the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt.
You know what? It had to, because let me tell you, it was the most confusing menu ever. Talk about restrictions. It wasn't like what you can cook. I mean, here's what you can't cook. It was everything. You can't mix this. You can't have that. It was every type of restriction imaginable. I can tell you one thing. It had a lot of legumes and a lot of vegetables.
Those were safe. I want to thank Jeff Nathan for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His Abigail's website has all kinds of great stuff about him. Jeff, thank you so much.
I thank you. I really appreciate it. It was awesome talking with you.
My pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll get a final musical play out and hear about next week's guest.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique,
Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us on Too Jewish this morning with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock when our guest will be Howard Megdahl, author of the delightful book, The Baseball Talmud. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning is for Hanukkah, now in its fifth day, which means tonight is the sixth night. Put in seven candles and light them left to right. It's my father, Rabbi Inkenter Baruch Kohan's setting of Hanerot Halalu, sung by a kids' choir. May these lights symbolize freedom and dedication for you this week. May you be blessed with a Chag Chanukah Sameach, a happy holiday of Hanukkah, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a last week of 2011 of peace.